This is David Hufford, Archetype of War, October 14th, 1991.
I don't know if you want the date. It's Monday, October the 14th, 1991. Okay. What I'd like to do is give my lecture. It's a lecture that has a lot in it. It felt very dense to me as I was writing it. And what I've tried to do is be as concise as possible with my focus so that we have plenty of time for discussion, because that's really what I like to do. I like to interact with people. I like to get a discussion going about the topic. So that's been my purpose in writing this lecture, is not to tell you, what you're supposed to think about this, but to give you a sense of thinking about so that we can all sort of discuss it together. This lecture was conceived 9 months ago, almost to the day, on January 14th and 15th, as a result of my own response to the beginning of the Gulf War. Until that point, I probably felt that a full-scale war was not a realistic possibility in the world today. And as a consequence, I was shocked and dismayed that one seemed imminent. At that time, as you all remember, there were many dire predictions as to what would happen if the war began. At the same time, I kept reassuring myself, as I'm sure many of you did, that something would give at the last moment, or that just because the deadline had passed, it didn't mean that combat would necessarily begin. But I became acutely aware of other feelings arising in me also as the 14th moved into the 15th. It was a growing sense of excitement and anticipation becoming stronger as the deadline neared. I realized that I was in the grip of a wave of collective feeling, what Jung called archetypal possession. I imagined that this was what the pilots and soldiers were feeling in the Gulf. But I also realized that this enthusiasm was probably being felt nationally, if not internationally, even among those like myself who were opposed to the start of hostilities. It made me disturbingly aware of my own capacity for war. It also created in me the idea for this lecture, to talk with others about our capacity for war as a way of trying to understand what that is. I tell you about my emotional confusion because in important ways it is symbolic of what I am going to talk about. War, combat, nuclear weapons, apocalypse, all of these realities are not simply black and white, for or against. In good Jungian fashion, I want to look at and for the opposites within them, the hidden meanings which we respond to but are not conscious of, to understand the issues better, but more importantly, to begin to find ways of saving ourselves from ourselves. In depth psychology, it is a truism that in order for healing to occur, what has been repressed or what is shadow must be brought into consciousness and face. First, so that it will no longer exercise its role as an unconscious, autonomous complex which presses to be acted out. But also so that the positive value and energy hidden within it can be released and used for continuing individuation. My hope is that this lecture and our discussion will further that process in regard to war and the nuclear threat. Having said that, however, I want to acknowledge that a tension exists in this desire to make conscious, to humanize the unconscious. On the one hand, it is a desire to get under ego control that which it experiences as danger, that which the ego experiences as dangerous, or frightening, or out of control. On the other hand, it is also a genuine desire to be in relation to the archetype, the transcendent, to manifest the God through human awareness and know it. There is a tendency we all have to want to relieve this tension by experiencing one or the other, but not both. It is important that a balance be struck as much as possible. Otherwise, there is either the danger of being overwhelmed by unconscious experience or reducing it to ego control, driving out the numinosity of experience and back into the unconscious where it gets acted out as a conflict. I have gone into this because collectively we experience a similar tension between the literal and the symbolic. We tend either to understand and respond to the world literally or respond to it symbolically, spiritually, if you will. Since the Enlightenment, Western culture has become more and more literal, driving out any awareness or experience of nature as symbolic or numinous. This is what science and technology are all about, to get the world under ego control, driving out all the symbolic meaning of things. But as David Miller points out, don't take literalism literally, in religion or politics. Literalism is just one of our myths, one of the perspectives through which we view our world. There is a need for balance, a dialectic between the literal and the symbolic, as both are necessary for understanding. If the symbolic meaning is suppressed, as it has been in our culture, there is a danger we will live it out in life, literally. I will talk more about this later, but I wanted you to be aware of this as we attempt to weave our way between the two in our look at war and nuclear conflict. Now, having said all that, I would like to preface the main body of the lecture by reading you a poem. In some ways, I think it sets the tone for what I want to talk about tonight. The poem is entitled When by Sharon Olds. I wonder now only when it will happen, when the young mother will hear the noise like somebody's pressure cooker down the block going off. She'll go out into the yard holding her small daughter in her arms, and there above the end of the street, in the air above the line of the trees, she will see it rising, lifting up over our horizon, the upper rim of the gold ball, large as a giant planet, starting to lift up over ours. She will stand there in the yard, holding her daughter, looking at it rise and glow and blossom and rise. And the child will open her arms to it, and it will look so beautiful. War is awful. We all know that. No rational person would want to start one or be involved in one. And yet, war happens, and with frightening regularity. The terrible secret of war is that it is both more horrible and more intensely exciting than anyone could imagine who has not experienced it. What is there hidden in war which unconsciously makes it so necessary and so seductive? in the 5,600 years of written history, there have been more than 14,600 recorded wars. That is 2.6 wars for each year of human history. The stories and mythologies of all peoples are replete with talk of war and the exploits of heroic warriors. In the last 150 years alone, the major nations of the world have gone to war on an average of once every 20 years, and these are only the major wars. The history of our species has been primarily the history of war. James Hillman reminds us that even the monumental epics that lie in the roots of our Western languages are to a large proportion war books. The Mahabharata and its That's right in the middle of the Mahabharata, big epic within an epic, explaining about war as and its relationship to existence. Including in the war books are the Iliad, the Aeneid, the Celtic Labor Gabala, and the Norse Edda. The Bible is mostly a long account of battles, wars, and warriors. In the Old Testament, Yahweh presents himself as a war god, his prophets and kings as warriors. Even the New Testament ends with the Revelation, which envisions the great Armageddon of the apocalypse, the final battle between good and evil, culminating in the end of the world. War is at the very foundation of civilization. Most, if not all, civilization, culture, and art has been disseminated through the process of war and conquest. Egypt, Persia, the Hebrews, the Romans, Greeks, India, China, Japan, European nations, Britain, and the United States, all of these cultures and civilizations came into being and spread their influence as a result of war. Practically all boundaries between nations, races, and religions have been decided by wars. To quote Anthony Stevens, armed conflict, like sex, seems to be a primary obsession of mankind. And it is safe to assume that where there is an obsession, there lurks an archetype. If we define archetype as ever-recurring, ubiquitous, highly ritualized, and passionate human events governed by fundamental psychological patterns, war seems to fit the bill. To understand the archetypal nature of war, I would like to look more closely at the human experience of it. To quote from the reports and descriptions of those who have been in combat to help us discover what may be hidden in its soul. The following is a quote from the diary of Ernst Jünger, describing the beginning of the last German offensive of World War I. The great moment had come. The curtain of fire lifted from the front trenches. We stood up. We moved in step, irresistibly toward the enemy lines. I was boiling with a mad rage which had taken hold of me and all the others in an incomprehensible fashion. The overwhelming wish to kill gave wings to my feet. The monstrous desire for annihilation, which hovered over the battlefield, thickened the brains of men in a red fog. We called to each other in sobs and stammered disconnected sentences. A neutral observer might have possibly believed that we were seized by an excess of happiness. We can feel the archetypal energy in this quote, the collective passion, the bloodlust, It hints at a dark joy in the experience of battle. Glenn Gray, in his book, The Warriors, writes, "Veterans who are honest with themselves will admit the experience in battle has been a high point in their lives. Despite the horror, the weariness, the grime, and the hatred, participation with others in the chances of battle have had its unforgettable side. At its height, there is an ecstasy. War has appealed because we discover some of the mysteries of communal joy in its forbidden depths." I don't know if any of you, or how many of you, have seen the movie Patton, but in it, there's a scene in which George C. Scott, as General Patton, walks through a field after a battle. The field is strewn with burnt-out tanks, the bodies of dead soldiers, destruction everywhere. He takes up a dying officer, kisses him, and looks about him saying, "I love it. God help me, I do love it so. I love it more than life." They love war because it is an initiation into the secrets of life and death. Confronting the beast of bloodlust and frenzy in themselves, giving themselves up to it and becoming one with it. Those who survive the test see the world with new eyes. A bond forms with fellow initiates that can be stronger than life itself. War is a union with blood and death, a dark conjunction. And the promise of that union is to be shown the secret of existence and to be reborn if one is willing to pay the awful price. William Boyles, in an article in Esquire magazine in 1984 entitled "Why Men Love War," went to the heart of the issue when he wrote, "The love of war stems from the union deep in the core of our being between sex and destruction, beauty and horror, love and death. War may be the only way in which most men touch the mythic domains in our souls. It is for men, at some terrible level, the closest thing to what childbirth is for women, the initiation into the power of life and death. It is like lifting off the corner of the universe and looking at what's underneath. To see war is to see into the dark heart of things, that no man's land between life and death or even beyond." But it is a flawed conjunctio. There is no conscious awareness and ritual containment of the experience. It is a literal acting out of a powerful collective desire for religious union with God, with murderous results. War continues to be a tragically flawed search for the masculine soul. Life is the initiation. If we need to go to war, or put ourselves in dangerous situations in order to learn the terrible, transcendent secrets of life, it is because of a failure of eros, not just for men, but for all of us. War continues to be a reminder of both our collective need and our failure to truly connect with the numinous passion of life. Now I'd like to talk about nuclear conflict. In 1952, in The Answer to Job, Jung wrote, "Since the apocalypse, we now know again, that God is not only to be loved, but also to be feared. He fills us with evil as well as with good. Otherwise, he would not need to be feared. And because he wants to become man, the uniting of his antimony must take place in man. This involves man in a new responsibility. He can no longer wriggle out of it on the plea of his littleness and nothingness. For the dark god has slipped the atom bomb and chemical weapons into his hands and given him the power to empty out the apocalyptic vials of wrath on his fellow creatures. Since he has been granted an almost godlike power, he can no longer remain blind and unconscious. He must know something of God's nature and of the metaphysical processes if he is to understand himself and thereby achieve gnosis of the divine. The only way that I would change the emphasis of that quote is that I would say that we have been granted godlike power, not almost godlike power. On August 6, 1945, with the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, the face of war changed forever. Since nuclear weapons were added to the armaments of war, we have been in a fateful struggle with ourselves for our collective survival. We have seen how compelling the urge to war has been throughout history. We have also glimpsed the desire for divine communion which drives it. But we now have the power of the dark god, the capability to create a conjunctio of blood and death, not just on the battlefield, but in the whole of creation. We have the power to literally create the apocalypse, the end of the world. How do we do what we have never been able to do since time began? Keep our lust for divine blood in check. Restrain ourselves from using all the weapons at our command. How can we collectively bring enough consciousness to bear to keep from unconsciously acting out the final Armageddon? Between the superpowers, there exists approximately 50,000 nuclear warheads, each one of which has several times the destructive power of the atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima. That one bomb killed over 100,000 people. The combined strength of the nuclear weapons on the planet is currently 1 million times that first bomb. We hold the destructive power of 1 million Hiroshimas in our collective hands. We are literally facing apocalypse. But in the spirit with which we began this talk, I would like to look at apocalypse both literally and symbolically, in the hopes of increasing our awareness of the unconscious nature of both apocalypse and our response to it. So what is the face of apocalypse? On the one hand, it is the literal end, the real end of the world. But it has a second, now largely hidden, symbolic meaning. In Greek, the word means revelation, disclosure, rather than merely closure. Further, if you look at its etymology, apocalyptian means to take the cover from, to uncover, especially as in a dream or a vision. The lifting or the tearing away of the veil of reality so that the greater reality behind it can be seen. Mythically and religiously, apocalyptic visions refer to a divine plan. The end of the world, certainly, but also the revelation of God and the rebirth of the elect in a cleansed, renewed world. So apocalypse is both the literal end of history in a transcendent vision of revelation and rebirth. if we see it only as death and annihilation, or only as symbolic renewal, we miss the point. We must sustain the gaze, hold the tension, and remain conscious of both if we are to survive. But, as I said earlier, since the Enlightenment, this second symbolic meaning has become largely unconscious, as life and nature have become more and more literal, drained of numinosity and transcendence. Because for us, apocalypse consciously means just the end, with no divine plan, no redemption, no renewal, no desire for, no redemption and no renewal, our desire for destruction and rebirth has been repressed. Unless we become aware of that unconscious desire for death and rebirth, we will be fatally drawn to act out literally what is in fact a symbolic need, just as we continue to do in conventional world. Hans Dieckmann refers to this as the Noah complex. He says, there seems to be in the psyche of man a deep disgust with the present world and a longing for a new beginning, a new start, in a virgin world where all the dreadful, faulty developments mankind has undergone are no more. There is the danger of living out an unconscious collective desire to bring about the end of the world in hopes of redeeming it. And of course, each one of us unconsciously believes in our hearts that we will be on the ark. There are two consequences to this psychic situation. First, we have literally lost hope. We know we can destroy ourselves, and this creates widespread guilt as well as emotional numbing. Traditionally, guilt is relatively contained in eschatology. If man is guilty, then God punishes him by destroying the world and recreating it in a purer form. But in our present conscious context, we threaten ourselves with destruction without any hope of redemption or renewal. Hope no longer refers to divine redemption, but only to man's faith in his own ability to solve the problem. This leads to further numbing, guilt, and despair. On the other hand, symbolically, we have lost the numinous, both in nature and in ourselves. We have lost our soul. Soul no longer resides in things, which includes us, because we know better. Science can take apart, analyze, and explain everything. Everything is just stuff. Science can't find soul anywhere, therefore it doesn't exist, or does it? If we have lost contact with soul in the world, drained nature of the numinous, there is only one thing left which still holds the power to awe and frighten us. Where the last genuine and real connection exists to something bigger and more powerful than we are, it is where the dark God resides, in the apocalyptic vials of nuclear weapons. The bomb is God, made literal and concrete. As Wolfgang Gigerich puts it, we have to realize that the nuclear bomb is not just a fluke of history, an unfortunate byproduct of science, but that it is the epitome and culmination of science, the product of modern man's highest and most sacred aspiration, his search for the ultimate forces of being and salvation. In the nuclear bomb is invested the soul of modern man. It is our reality, the real thing. All the riches of the imaginal are there, stuffed away, buried, and hidden, but also preserved in its terror, waiting to be redeemed. The question remains, how are we to deal with this dark God, which we have incarnated into matter? In the answer to Job, Jung talks about God's desire to become man, to incarnate into consciousness. He says, at first, God incarnated his good side. But God wants to become holy man, and this necessitates the incarnation of his dark side too. But clearly there is a problem. Jung points out that the unconscious wants to flow into consciousness in order to reach the light, but at the same time it continually thwarts itself because it would rather remain unconscious. That is to say, God wants to become man, but not quite. The conflict in his nature is so great that the incarnation can only be brought about by an expiatory self-sacrifice offered up to the wrath of God's dark side. Now the question is, what sort of self-sacrifice is required, and who is going to make it? Us or God? I want to suggest that since we have taken on the power of the dark side of God, we must make the sacrifice in God's name. Otherwise, we ourselves will be the holocaust, the burnt offering to the dark God, with no chance of redemption. In this regard, I would like to discuss the Greek myth of Prometheus. Fall back on a classic Jungian way of thinking about things. It is the story of suffering and sacrifice and may offer some hints as to what we must sacrifice. It is said that Prometheus was the creator of man. It was he who, with earth and water, some say, with his own tears, fashioned the body of the first man into which Athena breathed soul and life. Now, I would add that, just to remind us that Athena was one of the gods of the war, the goddess of war, along with Ares. So Athena breathed soul and life into the first man. After that, Prometheus had a special interest in man and lived among them. Now, Prometheus was a Titan, an earlier divine race which preceded the gods of Olympus. Zeus was the son of a Titan, and when he deposed his father, a terrible war took place between Zeus and the Titans, which Zeus eventually won. Prometheus had remained outwardly neutral, and so after Zeus's victory, Prometheus, which means he who foresees, and his brother Epimetheus, which means he who reflects only after the event, both Prometheus and Epimetheus were allowed into Olympus. But Prometheus held a silent grudge against Zeus for destroying his race. Zeus, unlike the Titans, asserted his divine supremacy over men, and a meeting was held to determine what portion of a sacrifice made to the gods belonged to the gods and what portion could be used by men. It turns out that when a sacrifice was made, only a certain portion had to be given to the gods. The rest of it could be taken back. But Prometheus was in charge of the negotiation, and he tricked Zeus into choosing only the bones and the fat of the sacrificed animal. When Zeus discovered this, in his anger, he withheld fire from man. Fire was to remain a divine prerogative only. But Prometheus knew where Hephaestus, the divine blacksmith and the most inventive of the gods, kept his forges. He snuck in and stole a brand of the holy fire and carried it back to men for their use. Outraged by the theft, Zeus ordered Hephaestus to fashion a creature of dazzling beauty to be sent to Epimetheus as a gift. Her name was Pandora. Even though his brother had warned him not to accept any gift from Zeus, Epimetheus was enchanted by Pandora and, quote, made a place for her among men, unquote. That was a grave mistake because Pandora brought with her a great vase. Now, incorrectly, you know of it as Pandora's box, but in fact it was a large vase. And when she raised the lid of the vase, all manner of terrible afflictions escaped into the world, including death. Only hope was not allowed out into the world and remained trapped in the vase. Such was the will of Zeus. In addition to punish Prometheus, Zeus ordered Hephaestus to bind Prometheus in unbreakable chains to a high peak in the Caucasus Mountains and to drive a stake through his liver. Each day, Zeus sent his eagle to feed on his liver, and each night the liver grew back. In spite of the torture, the Titan remained defiant and expressed his hatred of Zeus in violent outbursts. Finally, after 30 years of suffering, some say 30,000 years of suffering, Zeus gave permission for him to be released. The reason why he finally was released was not because he was repentant, but because he knew a secret. He knew something about Zeus that Zeus needed to know. What he knew was a secret that his mother, Prometheus' mother, had told him, that there was a particular immortal that at that time Zeus was interested in. Zeus was interested in a lot of immortal women in Olympus. And the secret that Prometheus knew was that if Zeus pursued this relationship and had a child by this goddess, that son would overthrow Zeus just as he overthrew his father. So finally, in exchange for this secret, Zeus released Prometheus. But Prometheus could not acquire divine immortality again unless some immortal agreed to exchange destinies with him. Now the centaur Chiron, whom Hercules had accidentally struck with a poisoned arrow, was left with an unhealing wound. So to end his suffering, Chiron begged to be allowed to descend into Hades in the place of Prometheus. Zeus consented, and from then on, Prometheus took his permanent place on Olympus as one of the immortals. The Athenians worshipped him as the benefactor of mankind and the father of all arts and sciences. Now, there is a great deal which is of interest in this story, but for tonight, I want to focus on the related themes of binding, woundedness, and sacrifice as exemplified by Prometheus, Hephaestus, and Chiron. Since Prometheus was a Titan, let's find out more about what sort of energy this is, because it's an energy in us. Kerenyi says the Titans were celestial gods, but gods of very long ago, still savage and subject to no laws. He goes on to say that according to Hesiod, the term Titans is actually a term of abuse and a pun, meaning both to overreach oneself and punishment. This is indicative of what titanic behavior is like: unboundaried, excessive, and liable to punishment. In a recent essay, Rafael Lopez Pedraza talks about Titanism as a form of madness which permeates our culture. With heroic hubris, we believe we can create anything, do anything, master everything. Nuclear weapons are the culmination of our titanic belief in our own power. Certainly it is true that out of our unbounded belief in our own possibilities, we have created much that is wonderful and worthwhile. But our unlimited titanic nature has led us to the brink of annihilation. In giving the gift of fire, Prometheus gave man both the creative possibilities of civilization and destruction. Fire was a divine power, and by accepting it, man accepted divine responsibility. Hephaestus is the counterpole to Titanism. He not only represents boundaried creativity, but he is also associated with wounded shame and vulnerability. In contrast to the other immortals, who were distinguished by beauty and the symmetry of their bodies, Hephaestus was ill-made and lame in both legs. His feet were twisted. His stumbling gait and dislocated hip aroused the unquenchable laughter of the immortals when he walked among them. He was lame from birth, and Hera, his mother, was so ashamed of him that she tried to hide him from the other gods. Eventually, she flung him out of Olympus into the sea, where he grew up in a deep grotto. So it is no surprise that Hephaestus represents the binding of Titanism, for he too was wounded. He knew the shame, rejection, and ridicule, and was the only god to know the limitation of physical imperfection and deformity. In the language of the myth, we need to call forth the creative binding energy of Hephaestus and daily, continually bind our Titanism to the rocky crag of human limitation and vulnerability. The binding of our Titanism must include an awareness of shame, guilt, and suffering. We must strive to become more sensitive and aware of the humanity, the capacity for woundedness, shame, and suffering of those who wound us. But in the myth, binding is not enough. Prometheus suffers, is wounded with an immortal wound, but he does so unwillingly and remains unrepentant. He is eventually released, not because he has learned his lesson, but because he has a secret that his mother told him about Zeus, a secret Zeus needed to know and eventually traded for his release. Even after being released, however, Prometheus was restricted to the world of mortals and banished to die like a mortal. Only through the grace of Chiron is he given the gift of divine immortality. Chiron is the archetypal image of the wounded healer. A centaur, half horse and half man, he contains in his nature a balance of conscious and unconscious. He is a wise teacher and a master of the arts of healing. He tutored most of the heroes and even some gods, including Artemis, Apollo, and Asclepius, the god of healing and health. But Chiron himself has a wound which cannot be healed. And to heal it, he must sacrifice his immortality, accept limitation. In the process, he redeems Prometheus' titanic nature and allows him to move into his proper realm, giving divine power back to the gods where it belongs, rather than in the service of man's titanism. Like Chiron, we must sacrifice the illusion of our immortality, the heroic belief that we can control anything, survive anything. We must voluntarily sacrifice the titanic belief that we can control the atom bomb, both that we can ban it, make it go away, and that we can use it, either as a deterrent or in a limited nuclear exchange. It is greater than we are, out of our control, a genie that can never be put back in the bottle. The atom bomb is our immortal wound. It is the madness in us that can never be cured. Our task is to accept our woundedness and our fate. We must be ever vigilant, not in a heroic sense, but with the vigilance of those who keep watch at the tomb, the vigilance of grief and sacrifice. We must finally give up any notion that we can conquer the madness of nuclear war, because this madness is God, the dark God of the apocalypse. Only then is there any chance of redemption. Thank you. What I'd like to do is take a few minutes and give us all a chance to take a breath, and then come back for discussion, questions. I don't know about you, but I've been having to take my breath. Does anybody have a burning question that they're just dying to? Yes.
I'm not real familiar, or I'm not familiar with the Jung's answer to Job, but but I think it's one thing perhaps to talk about both evil and good, if you want to use a conventional language, coming from God, and another thing to talk about war as somehow coming from God. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could just talk about that or speak to that in some way. I think I can accept that there's something in reality and human nature and the universe that tends toward evil, and that can be exaggerated or can be minimal, and that there's also certainly the other side, the good, the movement toward the good, the holy union, et cetera. But it would be another step, and maybe it's a step you could address in your case, to say that somehow the movement or the tendency toward evil, particularly war as evil, is also a movement toward God.
Okay. I'm aware that I've been asked to paraphrase the question, so I'm gonna try and for the tape, I'm gonna try and do that. And you tell me if I've sort of got what you're asking. That it's one thing to talk about good and evil, maybe in the abstract and whatnot, but what does it mean to say that evil comes from God? And more specifically, what does it mean to say that war comes from God? That war is somehow a part of God. That's a pretty disturbing suggestion. In answer to Job, Jung talks specifically about the incarnation of God. He's looking at the Christian story, or the Christian incarnation of God in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament and the New Testament. And he talks about Job and Job's relationship to God, and then how that sets up the necessity for God to incarnate as man in Christ. And his suggestion there is that when Job was given a raw deal, I'll put it in my own language, when Job was given a raw deal by God, it was because God was unconscious in some way. I'm paraphrasing Jung. That basically God and Satan got into an argument about whether or not there was a man that was so holy that no matter what happened to him, had so much faith that no matter how miserable his life got, he would still believe in God. He would still trust God. And so they made a wager. attention. And the things that happened to Job and God's, Yahweh's inability to have consciousness, have empathy, have compassion for what he was doing to Job, Jung suggests sets up the necessity for God to become man, to incarnate into human awareness in order to understand man. That in that moment, Job was more conscious than God, because Job knew what was going on and God didn't. Now, that's in one of the quotes I gave, that's why he said God had to incarnate first his good side. That was Christ. But there's still another side, that God has a dark side. That's been split off in the Christian tradition and in the Western tradition. And so there is a new incarnation, a further incarnation necessary. And that's the incarnation of the dark side of God. And it's out of that idea that it occurred to me, as I wove it, wove the ideas in the lecture, that as we've taken the transcendent, our connection with the God out of nature, out of existence, where it's ended up is in the nuclear weapon. And it's in war, it's in the desire to use that, to incarnate that, to make that a reality, that the dark side of God seems to be residing. In all religious experience, there is a deep connection between death and life, between the divine and the horrible. It's much easier to see in more traditional or pre-Christian traditions. Let me stop at this point, because I don't know if I'm answering, I don't know if I've really answered your concern.
Well, that we make it a pretty narrow question. How do you make the leap from the reality of evil, mm-hmm. whether it's in us or...
Yeah, whatever evil is. I mean,
whatever it is, to that evil, that evil manifested as war or complexion or... I guess it sounds like it's making a clear, obviously, you're saying, you know, this is a clear choice, that it's not coming from humankind, but it also comes from God.
Yeah. It's like trying to divide the literal and the symbolic. I mean, trying to divide, in some way, trying to divide where does human being stop and where does the divine begin? There's this dialectic that's going on all the time. As we live out our life, and as we collectively live out existence, we're in some way trying to incarnate something of the divine. And part of my lecture is suggesting that one of the ways that collectively, as well as individually, we have always tried to incarnate some transcendent initiatory experience for ourselves is through war. And The problem, of course, is that we're in a place where we can only do that once now, to really do it. And then we can't, you know, we literalize it once and it's all over. You had your hand up. Okay, you're saying that what you heard in my lecture was the dark side of God into the bomb, but also into science, and we have some question about that. Right. I'm good. Okay. Yeah. Well, I agree with you, and I wanted to say that if I didn't mean to suggest that I didn't mean to equate science with darkness or the dark side of God. If that's what you heard in the lecture, then I wasn't clear enough. I wasn't clear enough. That I agree with you. That in fact, science and technology and all the ability, all the creative ability that human beings have for creation, have both dark and light, positive and negative, good and bad possibilities. That's what I was trying to suggest. In talking about Prometheus and about literalism. But it's not bad that we have been able to see and experience and being able to experience the symbolic reaction. Well, there are lots of ways I could describe it. It might mean knowing that in a particular tree is a spirit of that tree, and that spirit has a relationship to me. That I have a relationship to something transcendent in my world, the spirit of the tree, or the crow that might come and speak to me, might come and give me medicine. Okay. Ask the question again now.
Well, you said experience the world symbolically as a place to live. Okay.
A symbol is something that hints at something beyond it. Something that stands for something else than the sun. But a symbol hints at something beyond what can be seen. And what I did in my lecture, and you may not agree with this, but what I did in my lecture is I generally equated symbolic, luminous, transcendent, than as opposed to the a literal response to the world. That's one of the ways to experience the world symbolically, is to talk about it as a spiritual. Experience the dark symbolically. Well, it's one of the things I tried to do, at least hint at in my lecture, in talking about war, for example, from a symbolic point of view. That on the one hand, war is a horrible experience. When you kill people, people are trying to kill you, you see death and destruction all around you. On the other hand, there's also something else going on. There's some unconscious need that's being lived out. It's a symbolic need. It's a transcendent need. It's not a literal need to kill somebody else. It's a need to be initiated into something. That's the question. That's the question. That's what we're here for. That's what we're here for. We're here to figure out what that is. I mean, I've got all sorts of words, and they may or may not make sense to you. But that's the point. The point is that it's something that's beyond us. You can call it God, you can call it the numinous, you can call it universal intelligence, you can call it animal medicines, you can call it all sorts of things. But it's something that creates meaning in the world beyond just, you know, this is a piece of wood and this is a carpet. And I mean, the carpet by itself has no meaning. There's nothing that's beyond it. And it's transcendent even in a mundane way. It's transcendent because it's an experience that takes us out of ourselves. We don't experience the world the way we normally do. We experience it in a very heightened way. Well, that's true, and yet one of the things I found that because I have always assumed that too, and one of the things I found in reading about this is that there is also a long tradition at least in Western culture and the history of war that of badly treating veterans. And when Frederick the Great needed an army, he was very happy to conscript all these people to go off and fight in his war, but once they won the war for him, they came back, and what he did is said, well, I'll make it legal for veterans to beg, because, you know, they need a place to keep alive. So yeah, he just sort of threw them out on the street and said, good luck, guys.
Well, that being true, we, after the Second World War and the Korean War, we didn't have vets come back and drown themselves in alcohol and what it brings out.
Well, not as much. I would suggest not as much.
And it also happened with the Russian army.
Right. I would suggest that it happens a lot. At the end of every war, it happened more with Vietnam and with Afghanistan because we were even, as a culture, we were even less supportive, less accepting of the process of the war and the process the purpose and the process of warring that we had sent them off to do. One of the things that I tried to hint at in my talk is that one of the things that makes this attempt at conjunctio, if you will, in war flawed, is because it's an initiation without a container. It's not like having a true initiatory experience into a process where you start out and you're given a new identity. Your old identity is taken away, and you're given this new identity, but in a realm that is outside of normal human existence. Okay, and war, that's when you go into boot camp. Okay, you step outside of normal existence, and you go into the army. You go into a world that has separate rules, separate ways of looking at life. You're given an initiatory experience, but then at the end of any initiation, the last piece is that you come back out of that liminal place and you re-enter society with a new identity, an identity which is based on what you experienced, the secret that you were given within that liminal space. And as an initiatory experience, we fail to do the last part because the whole initiatory aspect of war is all unconscious. I mean, we don't go into it saying, okay, now this is a way for all of us to experience some sort of connection with the divine. You know, and what happens is people come back from war. Obviously, as you know, people come back from war and society says, okay, well, now it's time to just be like you were again. You know? We don't want you to be new. We don't want you to be somebody new. We don't want to have anything to do with what war was really like. We don't want to know how horrible it was. We don't want to know how wonderful it was. We just want you to forget about it and go back to being the butcher or the truck driver or the cab driver or whatever you did before. Just pretend like it never happened. There's no allowance individually or collectively for any kind of acceptance of what the experience was, what we were really doing. Yeah. At least in more traditional cultures, there's some acknowledgement of this. For example, in Native American culture, there's a ceremony a purification ceremony that happens for battle. And then there's another purification ceremony that happens when they come back. They are purified, it is recognized what they've done and what they've learned, and they are given a ritual purification so that they're now cleansed to come back into society in a new way. And we don't even do that. We just say, okay guys, here's your veterans benefits. Good luck. You know, maybe you can find something to do in junior college. Until they can go through that process of cleansing and purifying and reemerging. Well, on the one hand, I want to say I think every one of us should walk out here tonight and do concretely and literally whatever we can to try and discourage war and try and discourage and reduce nuclear harm. On the other hand, I think to the extent that any of us believe that we can ban the bomb, that we can do something which is just going to unilaterally or bilaterally or whatever, we're going to do away with nuclear weapons, and that the world's going to go back to the way it was before nuclear weapons were created, is coming from a place that is just as literal as the policymakers in Washington that think that if we just get enough dirt and show people how to dig down 3 feet and have a solid core door and put dirt on top of the door that everybody can, you know, most of the people in America can survive a nuclear war. I mean, that was, remember, do you remember that? I've got a quote here somewhere. But there was, I don't know if you remember that in the Reagan era, that there were policymakers who came out publicly and made a statement that we got this way that, you know, nuclear war is survivable, guys. All we need is to get everybody out of the city. We have this plan to sort of evacuate everybody from the city, and you give them a shovel and a door, a couple of doors, and you make your temporary bomb shelter. nuclear war can be survived. That's there's a literalism in that that is denying the facts and denying the psychological facts. And but there's also a literalism in believing that we can go back. I suppose what are the messages that people that come back from war bring to us that we fear that are denied? I suppose initially what I would say is that what they experienced and what they bring back that they probably are not even aware of, or if they're aware of, they're ashamed of, is the wonder of war, the wonder of experiencing the world in a totally new way, in a way that it's like, if you think of all the descriptions of religious ecstasy in terms of experiencing nirvana or experiencing satori, enlightenment in Zen Buddhism, or experiencing the ecstasy of connection with the saints, or so any description you could imagine of religious ecstasy, and being able to experience the world in a numinous way, where the world has an incredible quality to it that makes it and you feel more alive than you've ever felt before in your life. That's at least on one level, that's the experience that many people have in combat that they cannot bring back. Number one, because we don't want to accept it. Number two, because even if they're aware of it, they're ashamed of it. They're ashamed of feeling, I fucking like this. Is that what you're hearing?
No, but there must be another type of civilization.
Yeah, absolutely. The other side is that we have to accept that we can no longer find a way to reach this kind of transcendent experience through war. Because from now on, war always is going to mean the possibility of nuclear war. And every time we go to war, like we did in the Gulf, nuclear war always is a possibility. That's always the danger. And we got away with it this time, because Saddam Hussein didn't happen to have his nuclear development project far enough ahead. That's one of the reasons why we can never put the genie back, is because even if tomorrow the United States and Russia said, okay, fine, let's just, we've made an agreement, we're going to do away with every one of our nuclear weapons, that doesn't mean nuclear weapons go away. And what we have to do is we have to accept the fact that we have something that we can never put down. I guess that the analogy in a mundane way, the analogy would be like, you've all seen in the movies, somebody takes a hand grenade and they pull the pin and they say, okay, coppers, I'm coming out, and unless you give me a bus to the airport, I'm going to blow myself and everybody else up with it. Well, it's like collectively we've pulled the pin and we're holding the hand grenade. And we can't put it down. And so we have to learn to live with it. We have to learn that we can't put it down and we can't use it. And so what do? We have to give up the idea that we know how to solve this problem. We have to give up the idea that we know how to fix it, that we can make it all better. We can, and you know, that we just figure out the right diplomatic or technological solution to this, and everything is going to be fine. The world is new now, in that sense. Yes.
Of all of these things, because I remember the week of January 15th, uh-huh. I was watching a program on public television about the Vietnamese war, and the one thing, we learned from that, never again will be some testimony over on the other side of the world is the war, and that very, as he said there,
well,
and we were going to purchase the war, we could get rid of Saddam Hussein, who was building power. And so how do you give a man who is eaten with the desire for power the idea that he can bring transcendent experience to people throughout the war?
We have a collective problem. I can think about it, and I can talk to you, and you can talk to me about it. But the problem is, obviously, it's just not us in this room that has to solve it. It's the entire human race. As a human species, we have to solve the problem. And that means we have to get together to solve it. And I don't know. I mean, that's I saw the plan of things.
Can you do it individually?
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of people are coming out of the airplane looking for a landlord.
Sure.
Is that
bungee cord jumping, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Is that a substitute on an individual that can become the collector?
Well, yeah, it is a substitute. I mean, just like football games are a substitute, right? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, temporarily, maybe. But the problem is it's a substitute in a literal way. It's still looking for the same conjunctio. It's still looking for the same, connection with the transcendent. With how do you lift off the edge of life and look underneath it? You know, it's still looking for that same thing, and it's still doing it literally. Well, the experience is numinous, but it's experienced unconsciously. It's like, wow, wasn't that a rush? Did you go on the roller coaster too? Wasn't that incredible? Let's do it again. I was scared to death. You know, let's do it again. I mean, you know, it's exciting. It's fun. I mean, you know, but it's like, how do we figure out what the real excitement is? How do we go beyond just sort of getting our thrills by riding the roller coaster and figure out what it really is that's a part of that that we're unconscious of, that's the real excitement? What does it mean? What is that? Clarice?
Oh, I was just going to make an observation. I was wondering if anyone else is
yeah.
Which is part of the issue.
Yeah.
Which is part of why we're here,
mm-hmm.
talking about what we're talking about, is because of that experience. I mean, I'm sure that's what we're talking about.
It is, well, I'm sure, I think you probably, in that regard, you probably represent 99% of the population.
Well, it's really, it's just a small percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I said to myself and to my friends when I decided to give this lecture, and we got on toward June, and you know, May and June, and the Gulf War, of course, was a glorious success, and everybody came home to bands, and I thought, you know, by the time October rolls around, either there is going to be an overflow crowd, or it's just going to be friends and neighbors. And I'm glad to see that it's not just friends and neighbors. But I really want to appreciate those, you know, all of you who came for being willing to sit and think about and hear me talk about a very hard subject. On the other hand, I also want to say that I struggled with a lot of anguish and a lot of depression over this, at least get it contained and separate it out. But I mean, this is horrible stuff, and I sat with it for 9 months. So thanks for helping come in and helping me diffuse a little. Yeah. Do women have less tendency toward war because they have the natural experience of childbirth? I was wondering if this question was going to come up, because one of the books that I read in preparing for this talk was a book by Anthony Stevens called The Roots of War. Doug has it out here. It's an excellent book. In some ways, in one book, it probably touches on all the issues, all the relevant issues, more fully than any other book. The thing about it, though, is that Anthony Stevens' main thrust of his argument is that war is a masculine problem. Men go to war. Now, that's true. Men do go to war. Very few women go to war. But Anthony Stevens' argument is that war is an archetypal problem only for men. That men have this, in their biology, have this archetypal urge toward war. Now, all the stuff I've been saying about initiation and everything, that still is true, but Anthony Stevens wants to say it's only true for men. And it's only men that have this desire to do this. Now, that's an interesting notion. It also puts him in bed, if you will, with a lot of feminists, or at least some feminist writers, who have recently, in recent years, been writing books talking about how it's only since the patriarchy that we've had war, that there was a golden era of matriarchy in prehistory, and I haven't really decided what I believe about that. You know, on the one hand, it's pretty compelling the realization that, yeah, pretty much only men go to war is pretty compelling. On the other hand, I'm just not willing, I guess I'm just, at this point, only willing to suspend judgment about it. I don't think we know enough about the archetype of the masculine and the archetype of the feminine to make very good judgments about what is just masculine, what is just feminine. Okay, but let me get to Bunny, because she had her hand.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right, and I
uh-huh.
Right, which he expanded into the book, and he got a little beyond the notion that it was simply deterrent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I hope I clearly had my tongue in cheek when I said that, because it's, yeah. I don't agree. I'm not willing to agree with that portion of his argument. But I think in other ways he lays out the problem very fully. If you can kind of choose to ignore the way he gets there, I mean, he has some good ways of defining the problem. I think you had your hand. It's a good question. Help me understand it some more.
Well, if I understand it correctly, war is drawn by the what? Is that right?
Well, all religious initiation, especially Judeo-Christian or Christian religious initiation, initiates only into the light. And in a way, that's part of our problem, is that we have initiation in this culture, starting from when, you know, Christianity started. Initiation, the initiation of connection to the divine has been only to the light side of God. It depends on your tradition. Some people would say God. Some people would say humanity. Yeah, it's the actual experience of being in the situation. That's the initiation. That's the transcendent experience. And what you said is that the complementary experience in war of giving birth is to watch the life fade from the person that you're holding. Yeah, a world without rules. That's Titanism, isn't it?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.